In the mid-1930s and 1940s, a whole host of young writers and critics emerged in New York around the magazines Partisan Review and Commentary, the latter which was founded in 1945 by the American Jewish Committee, in whose building we happen to find ourselves. Now, this eclectic intellectual community, the only European-style intelligentsia ever to form in America, included a majority of Jews, children of immigrants, who introduced European ideas and arguments into this Anglo-American society of which they were now a part. So intellectuals, you know, are driven by ideas, and they believe that ideas drive events. America's freedoms allowed this group to test that proposition in the most encouraging political environment, I think it's fair to say, ever known, and certainly ever known to Jews. This cohort of thinkers gained prominence individually and collectively as the New York intellectuals, although some of them hailed from Chicago. And this is our opportunity to review them and to really think about what their legacy may be. So there were many more outstanding figures than the ones whose work we're going to be discussing. And some have remained more familiar than others. But in no particular order, here are some of the names. Sidney Hook, Philip Rov, William Phillips, Irving Howe, Daniel Bell, Irving Kristol, Dwight MacDonald, Saul Bellow, Isaac Rosenfeld, Leslie Fiedler, Alfred Kazin, Delmore Schwartz, Lionel Trilling, Diana Trilling, Fred Dupuy, Tess Schlesinger, Robert Warshaw, Clement Greenberg, Meyer Shapiro, Lionel Abel, Mary McCarthy, William Barrett, Gertrude Himmelfarb, Norman Podhoretz, and Midge Dechter. Anyway, this is only an abbreviated roll call of the writers who cover a very large intellectual range. And just listing their names gives us notice of the small part of the picture that we are going to be undertaking in the next sessions and what I will manage to say about them today. Culture depends not just on the best of what is created, but it's also on the best of what gets transmitted, selected, and taught. And what remains of the writers and thinkers that I've listed is also going to depend on how and by whom they are interpreted. Until now, much of the writing about them has concerned their Marxism. Did they betray their radicalism, or did they preserve it? Or, as they evolved, how come some of them turned neoconservative? And what exactly was their influence as neoconservatives? What was their relation to modernism in literature and the arts? Were they the conduit of modernism into America? Or did they damp down its influence? They were mostly the children of immigrants, mostly from Russia, and concentrated in large cities. So what influence, if any, did this urban immigrant perspective have on America? And these are some of the questions that have always been raised about them. So in an early novel by Saul Bellow, a New Englander, by the name of Kirby Albee, feels that he has been personally harmed by a certain Jew, Asa Leventhal, and that America is being threatened in exactly the same way. He saw in the library a book about Thoreau and Emerson by a man called Lipschitz, and he can't understand how the American classics can be transmitted by someone who's essentially a foreigner. So Albee is afraid that the children of Caliban are ruining everything. Caliban is the creature, half monster, half human, in Shakespeare's play, The Tempest, if you recall, who boasts of having tried to rape Miranda, the young girl, in order to breed a race of monsters like himself. So to Albee, Jews, like the New York intellectuals, were the Caliban, posed and poised, not just to run the country, but to ruin it. And Bellow's book is moderately sympathetic to this American who thinks that Jews like Bellow, like himself, are corrupting the culture. Now, naturally, Bellow didn't agree that Jews were corrupting America, but he's alive to the reality that they were changing the culture and that some of his fellow Americans might see it as degradation. The book's title, The Victim, and this is a book of 1947, leaves ambiguous which of the two, Leventhal the Jew or Albee the New Englander, which is the victim of the other. So while some may have worried about Jews insinuating themselves into American culture, others noticed that Jews were in fact abandoning their heritage. So when Irving Howe came up with the term, the New York intellectuals, in an essay and commentary in 1968, he put their Jewishness in the background. And he wrote, "They came at a moment in the development of immigrant Jewish culture when there was a strong drive not only to break out of the ghetto, but also to leave behind the bonds of Jewishness entirely." And he recalls that Jewishness as an idea and sentiment played no significant role in their expectations, apart, to be sure, from a bitter awareness that no matter what the political or cultural desires, the sheer fact of their recent emergence had still to be regarded as an event within Jewish American life. And in this 23-page essay, he mentions the Holocaust in a paragraph, and the word Israel does not appear at all, the two defining events of Jewish life at mid-century. His bitter phrase, bitter awareness, tells us how they felt or how he thought they all felt about their telltale origins. So all of this changed very much over the next several decades. But most of the writing about the group still treats their Jewishness as a matter of very little intellectual importance. And you can see there are some really, there's one fine anthology of their writings, The New York Intellectuals. And there is no section at all devoted to their Jewishness. The word Jewish comes up in certain essays. For example, Nathan Glazer's essay about Jews and blacks, which is as fresh today as when he wrote it in 1964. But there is nothing there about their Jewishness. So it was taken for granted that this was something past. Now, I see this phenomenon a little differently right from the start. The importance of their Jewishness was, in the first place, that it could be downplayed. These young writers could ignore their Jewishness because it was self-evident. It never occurred to them to deny the obvious. They formed part of a critical mass, the densest concentration of Jews on the planet, 2 million in New York by 1950, one quarter of the city, further concentrated in certain neighborhoods. So raised in similar families, attending some of the same schools, filled with similar ambitions, these Jewish intellectuals, even without distinguishing racial features, were as identifiable as the blacks in New Orleans or the Asians in Ivy League schools today. Yet, unlike their Jewish counterparts in Europe, they were under no pressure to become anything else but Jews. And if I may, you know, there's a story told about Otto Kahn, the German Jewish investment banker of the earlier generation, who arrived in the States when he was 26 years old, already formed by the German experience of the Jew. And the story is told that he was walking along Fifth Avenue one day in the company of Marshall Wilder, who was a humorist and who also happened to be a hunchback. And Kahn said, passing a synagogue, he said, "You know, I used to be a Jew." And Wilder said, "You know, I used to be a hunchback." And so that's the kind of joke that was told about Jews who were trying to disguise themselves. But there was never any talk of conversion in the group that we are talking about. And if some of them changed their names, it wasn't to pass as being more American, but it was rather because their leftist politics called for an alias. Which is why some of them changed their names. So to sharpen this point, let's see how things looked from the perspective of a non-Jew, the philosopher William Barrett, was really, his book Irrational Man, I think, is still considered one of the finest studies of existential philosophy. Anyway, he wrote a memoir called The Truants, Adventures Among the Intellectuals, and he refers to the borough of Queens that he came from as a tentacle of the octopus Manhattan. Anyway, in the 1930s, he was admitted to City College, where he found his fellow students, as he said, somewhat grubby and ill-mannered, but probably the most dedicated body of undergraduates in the country. And this is how he writes about them. These students were mostly Jewish. The unofficial statistic rumored was about 98%, but this was probably a gross exaggeration. The more likely figure would have been somewhere around 95%. In any case, it was something of a shock for me at first to be thrown in an almost completely Jewish environment. At the time, the borough of Queens, where I grew up, had a very different demographic constitution from what it has since acquired. There had been very few Jews in the high school I attended, and in the successive neighborhoods to which my family moved. Jews were a very small minority. Now I was suddenly thrown, like Daniel in a den of lions, into a swarm of intense, squabbling, and noisy young Jews. Nevertheless, I seemed to have acclimatized myself quickly. I disappeared into the throng. I passed. There was nothing planned or self-conscious about this identification of myself with Jews. It simply happened. I became assimilated. So Barrett is not overstating the case. He was the one assimilating to the Jews, not they to him. He enjoyed becoming one of the lions in that den, and later becoming the closest friend of Delmore Schwartz, who is going to be the subject of our next session. What was happening at City College in the heart of Manhattan was what Bellow's character, Albee, feared. The Jews were not simply reading Thoreau and Emerson. They were becoming the purveyors of American culture and poised to turn New York into the intellectual hub of the country. Now, the second reason that Jewish thinkers and writers could afford to ignore their Jewishness, the more obvious reason, I think, was because it was not under attack. At least as important as their numbers and access to tuition-free college was the relative unimportance of anti-Jewishness in their environment. Now, there was prejudice, of course, and in becoming a professor of English literature at Columbia, Lionel Trilling had to overcome the chauvinism of professors who shared Albee's fears that Jews could not properly transmit American civilization. And Norman Podhoretz, as we'll see in one of the later essays, remembers being bullied by black neighborhood children. And Jews faced exclusion from restricted hotels and clubs and private universities. And of Jews who were drafted during the war invariably came up against some prejudiced officers and recruits. But we must differentiate, and I would always try to drive home this point. We must differentiate between, on the one hand, that American-style prejudice or discrimination, and on the other, anti-Semitism that organizes politics against the Jews. Germany under Hitler, starting in 1933, legislated against the Jews and attacked them ideologically. The Soviet Union in the 1930s legally and ideologically suppressed Jewish religion and nationality, prohibited Jews from having synagogues, from studying Hebrew, from observing their religious laws, forced them to obey laws that were against the Jewish laws. So American Jews, who suffered much less discrimination than black or at that point Asian Americans, were legally guaranteed the right to liberty, to life, to liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In sum, this group that we are discussing was the product of American exceptionalism, an intelligentsia formed in conditions of freedom and opportunity. And so now we can begin to look at some of what they made with this freedom. Well, this is a good place to begin with the place where William Barrett begins, in that den of lions. the City College, where some undergraduates got their education less in the classrooms than in argument with one another. Irving Kristol, who was educated there with Irving Howe, Daniel Bell, Seymour Martin Lipset, Nathan Glazer, and many others, describes the school cafeteria from a distance of about 40 years. He writes, "There were more than a dozen alcoves, and in a manner typical of New York's melting pot, each religious, ethnic, cultural, and political group had its own. There was a Catholic alcove, the turf of the Newman Society, a Zionist alcove, an Orthodox Jewish alcove. There was a black alcove for the handful of blacks then at CCNY, an alcove for the member of athletic teams, and so forth. But none of that interests him. The only alcoves that mattered to me were number one and number two, the alcoves of the anti-Stalinist left and the pro-Stalinist left, respectively. It was between these two alcoves that the war of words was fought, over the faceless bodies of the mass of students whom we tried desperately to manipulate into the right position, but about whom, to tell the truth, we cared little. We knew little and cared less." So Kristol calls his chapter Memoirs of a Trotskyist, because as between those two alcoves that mattered, he identified with the politics of Trotsky against those of Stalin. The difference between the alcoves was not over the Marxist ideal, but over whether the Soviet Union under Stalin could represent that ideal. Before long, those students in Alcove 1 began publishing their ideas, and some of them later became professors of philosophy, sociology, political science, editors of influential intellectual magazines, all that we will see. By the way, one of the people in Alcove 2 was Julius Rosenberg, who later became one of the United States' most prominent Soviet spies. So that's one starting point, those alcoves in City College. A second starting point in the formation of the New York intellectuals was this magazine, Partisan Review, which was founded as a publication of the communist-sponsored John Reed Club in 1934. And if you read the editorial statement, I'll only read one sentence of it, you can hear the echoes of the Soviet Party line, language. It says, "We shall combat not only the decadent culture of the exploiting classes, but also the debilitating liberalism which at times seeps into our writers through the pressure of class alien forces," and so on. And so the terms were dictated by Moscow, just as they were in other Soviet-sponsored newspapers of the time, like the Daily Worker and the New Masses, and of course, the Yiddish Freiheit. But after 2 years, the editors, William Phillips and Philip Rov, broke with the Communist Party, shut down the magazine, and then in December 1937, they started another magazine keeping the same name. But in this one, they declared their political independence. And you can tell immediately the difference in tone as well as in content. "Any magazine," they write, "any magazine we believe that aspires to a place in the vanguard of literature today will be revolutionary in tendency. But we are also convinced that any such magazine will be unequivocally independent. Partisan Review is aware of its responsibility to the revolutionary movement in general, but we disclaim obligation to any of its organized political expressions." So the word independence keeps recurring in this editorial statement, though the emphasis on political autonomy was at first, if you notice, very anxiously balanced by reaffirmations of their commitment to the left. So at first, these two versions of the magazine, before and after, were like the two alcoves of City College. The original one was Stalinist, The second one was a leftist deviation. And though the editors felt free to debate what would have gotten them killed in the Soviet Union, they were by no means willing to detach themselves from its political aspirations. And just to sum this up, the essay that we will be reading, or one of the two essays we will be reading by Robert Warshaw, has at the beginning, sums this up in these terms. These are the terms in which he describes this climate of opinion of the New York intellectuals in the late 1930s and 1940s. In this country, there was a time when virtually all intellectual activity was derived in one way or another from the Communist Party. If you were not somewhere in the within the party's wide orbit, then you were likely to be in the opposition, which meant that much of your thought and energy had to be devoted to maintaining yourself in opposition. In either case, it was the Communist Party that ultimately determined what you were to think about and in what terms. Now, so you see, Warshaw is here not describing those affiliated with the party, but the ones who are pulling away from it. And certain things are implicit in his observations. First, that the cultural climate of a country may be determined by a relatively small group of people, not necessarily those who are elected to govern us. If intellectuals are right about the power of ideas, their politics will greatly influence our voting one way or the other. Secondly, Soviet influence did not have to come directly in the form of payment or spying networks, or today, through internet interference. Its carriers were Americans imbued with its political vision of a post-capitalist, post-nationalist, egalitarian, and internationalist world order. That vision was so powerful that even those in opposition were working on the same assumptions, or working with the same language and trying to disprove it. And then the third thing is that independence, I think, depends on whom you are claiming your independence from. And to see how this matters, I compare it in my mind with the modern Yiddish and Hebrew cultural renaissance that took off in Russia in the late 19th century, and in the 1930s was still going strong in Europe, in Palestine, and here in America. Those writers were also affected by Marxism and by other modern intellectual trends, and they likewise insisted on their independence, but they were insisting on their independence from Jewish orthodoxy. So they introduced their new ideas in the vocabulary and context of the Judaism in which they were raised. Because they wrote in Jewish languages, engaged with Jewish texts, addressed Jewish readers who were basically in the same situation, and conducted their rebellion in Jewish terms, what they produced was a modern Jewish literature and culture. Not so these immigrant children educated in New York public schools. In their formative teens, they substituted communist orthodoxy for Jewish orthodoxy, and they situated themselves in the orbit of Russian and Anglo-American texts and ideas. The internationalist assumptions of the left made it very easy for them to join ranks with non-Jewish Americans like William Barrett and Mary McCarthy and others. And that is why those others in those same leftist circles felt so comfortable with them. The left offered entry into an undifferentiated society without the need for official conversion from Judaism, from the Jewish community, or from the claims of the Jewish people. And the same applied to Christians. And that common release from the bonds of childhood and the formative community inspired a new American culture. But here comes a curious paradox, I don't think fully appreciated at the time. Already removed from their Jewishness, or in geographic terms, from Brooklyn and the Bronx, these young people were now establishing their independence from the opponents of Judaism. So in declaring their freedom from the ideology explicitly opposed to nationalism and religion, which is the fused foundation of Judaism, they were heading back in the direction of their parentage. Without getting too fancy about the ironies of these American anti-Stalinists, when they recognized that communism was, as they called it, the God that failed, some of them gained new respect for the God that did not fail, for religion, or if not for religion, then for the Jewish and American civilization that was built on a religious foundation. And secondly, they could not keep ignoring Stalin's anti-Semitism and his attacks on Trotsky, with whom they identified as a fellow Jewish intellectual. I would not share that idea, but that's definitely the way they perceived it, and whom Stalin had assassinated in 1940. So at first they had accepted the Soviet claim to be the only effective force against Nazism in Germany, but then they came to recognize that communism in its own way suppressed human freedoms no less than fascism, and in some respects even more than fascism. And also, after serving in the American armed forces, as many of them did during the war, they experienced their adopted country as in fact what it claimed to be, a guarantor of liberty. So what we have in these people then is a process of separation and self-correction that never stops. They accepted or returned to Judaism on their own terms. People who think, and not only to Judaism, but they kept rethinking their positions from the very beginning. So people who think and rethink and then keep on rethinking develop intellectual self-confidence. Their writing is fresh, full of discovery. They all write like autodidacts. And in fact, those of us who are, in many ways, autodidacts, really gain a lot of confidence reading the New York intellectuals. It was their tremendous strength that they didn't draw their ideas from given sources, but kept really rethinking everything. And their writing, one of the reasons it's so exciting is it because it bears that out. And they are so very individual that it's hard to describe them collectively. Norman Podhoretz calls them the family. And Howe describes their interaction in three words. When Howe writes this essay about the New York intellectual, these are three words which are so precious. He says, attention was paid. And once you have so many good writers mattering to one another, paying attention to one another, they begin to matter to the rest of the country. Okay, so until this point, I've been emphasizing the political orientation of the group and in a much shorter framework. I would just turn briefly to two of the forces that were drawing them away from leftism. And the first very important force was their devotion to excellence in literature and the arts. So Alfred Kazin, who was also at City College in the 1930s, for example, explains the difference. He says, naturally, he considered himself a socialist, since everyone else I knew in New York was a socialist, more or less. But I was remarkably detached from it intellectually, and I spent my days reading William Blake and D.H. Lawrence and Walt Whitman. He felt moral compulsion to be a socialist during the 1930s, assuming that the Depression could only be overcome by a socialist government. But it didn't require any conscious decision on his part, he says. I was a socialist as so many Americans were Christians. I had always lived in a socialist atmosphere. But in the memoir that he wrote, which has become an American classic, memoir called A Walker in the City, Kazin traced his journey from the Jewish childhood and neighborhood in Brooklyn to his embrace of Western civilization with primary focus on the mastery of Western and Anglo-American culture. His happiest days were spent in the New York Public Library. And in 1942, at the age of 27, he published a book called On Native Grounds, An Interpretation of Modern American Prose Literature. It is a breakthrough study of American writers. It is still read and studied. This young man, writing it really on the basis of his readings, solitary, in the New York Public Library, in love with American prose literature. So once Kazin and others looked for excellence in art, they had to break away from political orthodoxy that reduced everything else to politics. The pursuit of great writing became one of the distinguishing features of the group and a defining feature of Partisan Review. And though literature was paramount for them, the magazine also covered all the seven arts: architecture, sculpture, painting, music, performing, and film. Clement Greenberg, Meyer Shapiro, Lionel Abel, Harold Rosenberg were pioneering art critics. Robert Warshaw was an innovator in film criticism, and so on. And from this group, you have some of the best literary interpretations that was ever written in America. So that's one force, this excellence in literature. And the second force that weaned them from leftist politics was their Jewishness, which was at first considered irrelevant and might have remained so had it not been for a surprising intervention. This was the founding in 1945 of Commentary Magazine, which also happened to be, like Partisan Review, the second version of an earlier publication. In 1938, the American Jewish Committee had founded a monthly called the Contemporary Jewish Record as a high-level house organ of the kind that major organizations sometimes sponsor in order to promote their aims. When its editor died in 1944, leadership of the AJC had the idea of harnessing the energies of this impressive new cohort of Jewish writers. They reorganized the magazine as Commentary, and they gave its new editor, Elliot Cohen, a relatively free hand in publishing, quote, a journal of opinion on Jewish affairs and contemporary issues. The young writers needed jobs, they needed a place to publish for pay, and though none of them had written for the Contemporary Jewish Record, now that they were promised their independence, they all participated in Commentary, some as editors as well as contributors. Elliot Cohen said he wanted a place where these intellectuals could shake hands with their Jewishness in public. And then he also said, the main difference between Partisan Review and Commentary is that we admit to being a Jewish magazine and they don't. So, but you see that behind this quip lies the fact that there now was a high quality Jewish magazine of general interest, and that made a significant difference to the American Jewish community. Now you see that the AJC was taking a risk. If these young people were openly leftists and distancing themselves at the time from their Jewishness, why would a Jewish organization subsidize their writing? And what were these free thinkers thinking when they entered this marriage of convenience with the Jewish bourgeoisie, which is certainly how they looked at the American Jewish Committee? Yet this shidduch, this match, turned out surprisingly well. Jews had been launching their own magazines from the dawn of modernity. You know, there was a Tel Aviv University founded an institute that dealt exclusively with research into Jewish magazines. You cannot imagine hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Jewish publications in every language. But no other Jewish magazine ever marched right into the public square, claiming expertise on both Jewish and general matters, and aiming to influence everyone, from congregational rabbis to the President of the United States, from the Hebrew teachers in Jewish high schools to professors at Princeton and Harvard. Commentary gave its contributors the option of writing inward or outward. In Partisan Review, they felt free to write outward without drawing attention to their Jewishness. And the result is Nathan Glazer's embarrassment 50 years later that the magazine, staffed so largely by Jews, wrote so little about their crises, the crises that the Jewish people faced in those years. On the 50th anniversary of Partisan Review, he wrote a very moving essay where he says this, how embarrassed he is by how little attention they paid in Partisan Review. But for their part, Jewish magazines of the time that were pitched inward to affiliated Jewish readers went in the opposite direction, so that an American Zionist publication like the Jewish Frontier, which was the first to bring reports of the Nazi killing centers, did so, but who else got to know about it? So the issue of commentary, the first issue of commentary, and with this we will end, it introduced a completely different model. There were back-to-back articles by the influential Protestant theologian Reinhold Niebuhr on the crisis of the individual and by Mordechai Kaplan on Reconstructionism. There were articles on George Gershwin's music and a piece entitled, Must the Jews Quit Europe? That needs frighteningly little update. So the appeal to the broadly educated and interested reader paid off because Jews were just then in America approaching the height of their popularity, and because talent was there to fill its pages. The stimulus supplied the organized Jewish community with an influential voice in American affairs, and it invited Jewish intellectuals to reintegrate their Jewishness into the best of their thinking. The couple of serious bumps in this relationship, and there were some serious bumps, were resolved on the side of editorial freedom, and America's atmosphere in the post-war years gave this magazine and the whole approach that this magazine introduced a great chance of succeeding. So once they began to regain their Jewish self-confidence, they were also ready to see the significance of the Jewishness that they had ignored. Harold Rosenberg said, for 2,000 years, the main energies of Jewish communities in various parts of the world have gone into the mass production of intellectuals. So who can be surprised by their mass presence in America? By the 1940s, Jews were not only writing the patriotic songs of America and making Christmas movies, but definitively interpreting America to itself and doing so and interpreting Jewishness to themselves as well. It was a very exciting time in our intellectual life, and we will see how it evolved. And also, we will think about whether we can ever hope to see its likes again. Thank you. The immigrants from Eastern Europe called this country the Golden Land, die Goldene Medina. And we're all familiar with the stories of children of immigrants who became millionaires, who became governors of states, or winners of the National Book Award. And as one of those great achievers, Delmore, however, warns, I think, against getting caught up in that golden glow.